Hi everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of Broken Millennials. And today we have a very different episode for you guys. We put a lot of hope, honestly, into this because this is something quite different from what we've done before. Today the topic of our discussion with our guest speaker is domestic violence. We are talking about something that's come up in the recent weeks much more than usually, and people are talking about this much more frequently, and honestly the statistical data does not show any positive results since the beginning of the lockdown. So today we wanted to explore this matter in more depth.
So I think it will also be important to mention that none of us ever faced any form of domestic violence. Nevertheless, we are very interested in the topic, and it brings a lot of negative feelings in both of us, and therefore, I don't know, we just wanted to cover that because of the situation that is happening in the world, and because this is something, I don't even know how to describe, but it's so close to your everyday life, it is so important on the daily basis, and just safety in your own home is so essential and so important. And I guess it's just such a wide and such a difficult topic, so we wanted to cover that, I guess.
Yeah.
Even though none of us experienced anything like this before.
Yes, it might seem that problems like that are always happening to someone else, but in reality, it's not a secret to anyone anymore that your neighbor, your best friend, or your relative might be facing some form of domestic violence. And this is something that you can't easily get away from, despite the absolutely outrageous view and often frequently asked questions why the victims of it don't just get out and just find somewhere else to live. This is not that easy. To answer some of the commonly asked questions, I would say, and the questions that are in particular interest for us as people who want to shed some light onto this difficult subject.
We take a different approach. I think it's important to mention that.
Yes, that's right. And we will talk about this in the interview in more detail, of course, but the approach that we chose to take and the expert that we chose to interview in this case, I would say it's an alternative approach to viewing this topic, because we're talking today with an expert who has worked with male perpetrators, mostly male. And this is an occupation which maybe some people won't believe exists, because usually most of the work, the counseling work, is done for the victim. And in this case, we're talking about someone who's worked with the aggressor side. Some of those were appointed by court, and the minority were voluntarily present there. So it's just very, very interesting, I think, for everyone to learn about something like that.
We don't only talk about the male aggression, we talk about education, we talk about culture, we talk from the perspective of two countries, basically US and Belarus. For people who don't know what Belarus is, it's a country in Eastern Europe. And because our guest currently works in Belarus and from Belarus, and well, basically this is the reason why we talk about US and Belarus, and we talk about this huge difference in the experience in the Western and Eastern world, where, for example, in US there is a very defined mechanism how to deal with domestic violence, while, for example, in Belarus, there is no definition of domestic violence, there are no mechanisms to deal with this issue, and, well, therefore, we explore this issue on the contrast of two very different countries, two very different cultures, and completely two different worlds. However, I think also one of the interesting things is that even though they are so different, there's always the room to grow and the room to, I don't know, to develop the issue in a greater depth, to talk more about the issues. There are many questions that are not answered yet. It was interesting for us, for sure. It was very educational for us, I think. And we hope that it will also be that for you, I guess.
Yeah, I hope that you learn something new from that, because for sure this is a topic that needs to be explained more and people need to be informed about it more, because misconceptions that are formed on the basis of oblivion about the subject and ignorance about the subject can be harmful for the society and for the development. So yes, I think it's almost a duty of a thoughtful citizen of any country, really, to learn about those things, and a thoughtful duty of someone who would want to change the status quo concerning gender inequality at the moment. So in the next few moments, you're going to start listening to the interview with Galina Desyatova. And she, as I mentioned before, she's working with male perpetrators. She worked in the US as a counselor. And now she's working in Minsk, Belarus. So I hope you learn from it as much as we did, and stay tuned.
My name is Galina Desyatova, and in my current position, I work for Gender Perspectives, a nonprofit organization in Minsk, where I run a project. I head the project on engaging men in gender equality, which is a new cutting-edge topic for feminist organization. To this project, I bring my previous experience as a counselor for men who use violence in their intimate relationship for a US Boston-based organization, also nonprofit, called Emerge. I used to run groups for men who better.
Yes, yeah, so, and we want to discuss primarily your work at the Emerge, a nonprofit organization. So we want to start with the basics, and we want to know how the whole process is happening. How do people come to you? How they find your organization, and why do they do so? Is it forced, or they are voluntarily come to you?
Yeah, so organization has been running since 1977. So 40 plus years. And the bulk of the clients are being referred. In other words, they have to come to the organization. And the force that pushes them is called probation, which in US realities is a very powerful force. Probation basically means you have certain conditions that you have to meet. Otherwise, you will go to jail. So mm-hmm. most of our clients, between 70-80% in different years, but roughly 70%+ are on probation. That is, coming to our program has been prescribed by the court. The rest, I would say about 15-20%, are referred by the Department of Children and Services, or which is called for short DCF. And that basically means that the government, in the form of Department of Children and Services, had to intervene in that particular family because children were witnessing violence of usually their father against their mother, and the parental rights are being suspended or are being reviewed, and therefore again usually a man has to come to this program. So the rest, very, very small percent, statistically insignificant, I would say, are called self-referred clients. And usually that means that either their long-term partner has asked them to come and is threatening divorce, or again, it could be a case of custody of children, where they're going through a divorce and he thinks it would be better. I'm saying he because most of our clients are men, about 90%. So yeah, so mostly probation, then Department of Children and Services, and then a small percentage of self-referred.
Mm-hmm. And so what is going on when they come to those centers? What kind of work is done with those people who either are self-referred or are on probation? So what is the mechanism of dealing with the aggression and with the behavior? What is the process?
So the process is the same for everybody, regardless of how they found our organization. They usually go through, not usually, but they have to go through intake, where basically they are assessed whether they are the right client for our program. So a bit of a side note, so to say, there are two major types of programs. The program that I'm talking about is called Better Intervention Program, or BIP, and then there's Anger Management Program. So Better Intervention Program is a 40-week program, so roughly 10 months or about a year. they have to attend. And it's primarily for people, men, who use violence in intimate relationships. Anger management, not primarily, but exclusively. Anger management, on the other hand, is for people, men or women, who use violence against random people in random situations. And it's a shorter 14 week program. So basically during the intake, we assess whether this person, our future client, is suitable for our better intervention program, whether they committed the right kind of violence, so to say. Also, part of the assessment is, do they have any substance abuse? Do they have any other problems that need to be addressed in parallel with our program? And how dangerous are they?
Mm-hmm. And how are those programs, who are they being sponsored by? Is it sponsored by government? Should people pay for that? How this process is happening? In the US, at least.
Yeah, great question. I was just going to say that, but I'm glad. Yeah, because I don't want to speak for too long. I want it to be more of a conversation. So yes, part of assessment is also assessing their financial level, because our program in Massachusetts was on a sliding scale, which means depending on your income, we take your income and assess it and see how much you will pay. That is to say, the fee ranged from $25 to $75 per session. And usually men come once per week. So they pay anywhere from $25 to $75 per week. That's part of the cost. And then, of course, the part of the costs are subsidized by the government as a nonprofit. And then there are other grants and funds that my organization assesses and amasses by fundraising. But most of the fundraising goes towards administrative costs. But most of the grants by U.S. government, federal grants, go towards their educational component, because they do a lot of educational work for judges, prosecutors, and general public.
Mm-hmm. And also, I want to ask, as most of those sessions, for example, as you have mentioned, they are probably in-person sessions. So how did the situation change during the pandemic, and how this is all happening right now?
Yeah, this is a great question, too, because pandemic has forced all of the sessions to go online, which certainly was a big change, because in 40 years, everything has been done offline, in person. And the key component that has to be resolved is, such programs basically have two clients, at least those that advocate for pro-feminist approach, which was my program. We have a client with us in the room, the man who we work with, but then we have another client that we're accountable to, and that's his partner, ex-partner, or current mm-hmm. partner. So as you can tell, by moving this everything online, there's a lot of danger in terms of how things that we discuss in the group, how confidential they stay, whether men actually are where they report they are, and how do we, throughout this program, we always make contact with his partner or ex-partner, and it's up to that, usually woman. I mean, there are groups for gay men, but we're talking about 90% of our clients are heterosexual men. So we always contact his partner, and it's up to a woman whether she wants to talk to us or not. But she's also, in a way, our client. The mm-hmm. security and safety of her is one of our biggest responsibilities, really.
Yes, and also, as you have mentioned, that you now you're currently working in Minsk. I want to ask about the difference, and primarily about the difference in the evaluation mechanism, because as you have mentioned, in the US, there is very good understanding of how, just because you have mentioned that in the US, it's pretty clear how to deal with men that are in this kind of situations, and how is it happening in Belarus, and in general, what is the big difference?
This kind of work is only budding. It's still at the inception stage. So how did I get involved with Emerge? Is that in 2012, we launched a project with the UN on addressing violence against women. And part of the project was initiating this kind of work with perpetrators. And Emerge was one of the organizations that we initially contacted to come to Minsk and do the training. We did not select them, but they graciously, 3 years later, they admitted me as a volunteer. That is to say that this work is not even 10 years old in Belarus. And I'm not currently engaged in this work, but of course I still know all the actors who are. And as Emerge themselves would tell you, and as I would say, or any, I think, pro-feminist experts on gender-based violence and violence against women would say, it's very, very dangerous to launch a program for perpetrators in the environment where there's no strong network of support for victims, for survivors of domestic violence. And by that, I mean, of course, shelters, hotlines, but also a big support from the society. The understanding that there is no, in a way, that it's just, let me rephrase it, that there has to be a strong support from the society in a way that women are not blamed for this kind of crime. And they're not viewed as provocators or holding responsibility for this crime, which is not where Belarusian society is at. And another strong component of such programs is accountability, which is basically incorporating women's feminist views, voices into holding men accountable. And this is still not even at the inception stage, but is basically being pioneered as we're talking right now within some of the projects. So there are a couple of initiatives in Minsk by psychologists who work with perpetrators, but it's all voluntarily. It's all meaning the men are not paying for it. They're, as far as I know, unless it's done individually on a one-by-one cases, because in US, it's all in group setting. So it's still very early to talk about that. And there's definitely no accountability mechanism.
And if we take the legal system of the United States and compare it to the legal system in Belarus, how is the US system more adapted? Because, I mean, we take by default that the US system is more adapted towards women in these cases. It's more open, so you can refer to legal services if something like domestic violence is happening to you. In what other ways that we probably don't know about is the US legal system adapted to that, and what are the counterparts of that in the Belarusian legal system?
Basically, the legal system is the reflection of, in a way, is the reflection of where society is with its values and principles. So there's no specific law in Belarus on protection of victims of domestic violence, survivors. There's no separate law, although the European legal bodies would advise that there should be one. In US, there's a specific act that since 1993, I think, Violence Against Women Act, that has been protecting women. And under that act, the federal government has considerable finances that they disperse to different women's organizations as well as better programs. Basically, like I said, in US, there is a very strong protection for women, which includes restraining orders that can be issued right there by the police. And the judge can uphold that order without women's consent. That is, if the police think that there's a need for that, they file for it and they receive it and it can be extended, which is not the case in Belarus. In 2013, within that project, I'd like to credit our project with that we did introduce restraining order in Belarus. But it's still, you need to have, perpetrator needs to be brought to the police twice within a year. So basically a woman has to sustain injuries twice within a year so that he can be removed from the house. And then again, if it's a former spouse, but they still live together, then he can't be removed because there's no definition and there's no specific law. There's still a lot of loopholes that leave survivors unprotected. And of course, the funding is a big issue too. So again, anybody would tell you that if the funding is scarce for domestic violence, then it should probably go towards survivors. And then it doesn't have to be divvied up again. Mm-hmm. And the survivors and the perpetrators program shouldn't have to compete for these funds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And from that, I think we want to switch a little bit into more sort of a psychological part of the domestic violence. And we want to talk to you about the behavior of the abusers. And so first of all, I understand that it is difficult to suspect that the person will be showing any signs of violence at the early stages, but if there are any kind of steps, can you share them with us?
So the red flags, the big red flag would be jealousy. I think that's one of the biggest issues that everybody would talk about, whoever works with the perpetrators. And then while there's no profile of an abuser, meaning that the age or the length of relationship doesn't give you really an idea of how abusive men can be. But I suppose you should always look for, we often say how abuse is a way of control. It's not a tantrum. It's not something you do on an impulse, although we like to think that it is something that we can't control. But basically, it's the opposite. It's the way to control your partner. So you should be looking for signs of somebody goes through your phone, somebody insists of what to wear, somebody says, I love you so much, don't go there because you make me very jealous. Somebody manipulates, or somebody wants to be very close to you very, very soon. So basically, there's no courting. He wants to move in with you right away. He wants to be on your, in every meeting with all your friends. He takes over your life within a matter of week or months.
Is there a division? So, I mean, what I wanted to ask, if the actions of a person, of a man who abuses a woman, are those actions premeditated from the beginning as they get to know each other and as they get closer? Because all the stories that we hear seem to begin like a fairy tale, and then they spiral down so unexpectedly into something so much worse. So is this real love for those men? Do they feel, or is it all just a fake and a way to, I don't know, to execute some plan that they premeditated even before they started doing it?
That's a very good question. Is it premeditated or is it an impulse? I don't think anybody goes into a relationship wanting to abuse or kill the other person. I mean, ultimately, all of us are looking for love. And it pains me to say, but I think it is a kind of love for these people. Mm-hmm. And I can actually juxtapose this with another question, because your question is from the perpetrator's perspective, but I think most people usually question victim's perspective. Why don't they leave a perpetrator? And the answer is that this is the kind of love that they know. If you haven't been loved properly, you might confuse abuse for love. So I think it's the same for a perpetrator. If you don't know how to love, your manifestation of love is ultimate control. Now, do they know what they do? Yes, they do. And we would argue that this is not an impulse, because we often ask them during the sessions, okay, so what kind of abuse did you do to your partner? And the answer would be, oh, you know, I never really abused her physically. I mean, it may vary, but they would say, I never really physically abused her, but I punched some walls, I bent some doors, I broke some things. So we would ask them, okay, can you tell us what kind of things you broke? I broke her iPad. I broke her china that her mother gave her. I broke the piano that she worked. I threw her phone against the wall. So the pattern is her, her, her. So on the one hand, we say, well, they like to say, oh, I lost control. I didn't know what I was doing. But you only broke her things. So how does that correlate with losing control and not knowing what you were doing? Or on the other hand, they would say, yeah, I might have put my hands around her neck and held her for, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds, maybe a minute. But if you hold somebody for more than 2 minutes, you might just kill them, right? So they know enough not to hold her more than 2 minutes. They hold her just enough to give her scare to the rest of her life, but not to kill her. So do they go with the plan to abuse and make their partner into a victim? I don't know if I can say that, but do they know what they are doing while they're in the relationship, that they are being abusive? Yes, they do. Yeah. And many of them do feel shame for that. And yet that does not necessarily mean they know how to stop doing that.
And you mentioned earlier that it's often, I would say, the question to the victim about her. What did she do? And that brings us to a social issue that we have when people view domestic violence and sexual abuse in general, they view it as a women's problem. So when they talk about a case, they talk about the man beat her up, but what did she do? And the fact that it's phrased like that it's a woman's problem, it kind of lifts the responsibility of a man to take action against it. They can step aside and say, oh, if it's someone else, they would say, oh, it's a woman's problem, women should deal with it. Do you have any support from the male, you know, spectrum of the society? Because it's very important to engage everyone, I think, in this kind of issue.
Yes, thank you. This is a very modern take on gender equality and gender-based violence. Because in our current project in Belarus, this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring men into discussion about gender equality, feminism, and what does it mean to be a man in the modern society? Because part of being a man is taking responsibility for power, entitlement, privileges, recognizing how you, in a way, just by virtue of being born a man and white men in our part of the world, you already hold a lot of privileges. You are already the most powerful person, I mean, the image of that you could be. And then if you unpack that, really, there's a lot that men need to deal with. And in terms of being responsible and being accountable to women and women's movement. But why I'm saying that your view is a very modern view is because if you listen, I mean, there's protection of survivors and shelters and women's movement and empowerment of women obviously has been going on with waves of feminism, but this current wave dictates us that we have to look at the root causes and listen to the voices of the survivors and tailor our work towards what they think is best. And many of those survivors would say, I don't want this relationship to end. I want him to change. So that brings us to that ultimate question, can people change? Can men change? And how can we expedite this change? Because basically this program, in case of Emerge, 40-week program, so within a year, you have to acquire these new skills. So say you're a 40-year-old man who comes into this program, and within a year, you are asked to not only stop bad behavior, but to learn new respectful ways of handling arguments, misunderstandings, your emotions, treating your partner and your kids. And of course, the goal of such programs is not to preserve relationship, but ultimately to make you a better human being, to make you a better partner for your ex-wife or your future partner or your present, of course. So I would say that not every feminist organization engages men. But if you do choose to engage men, it's a different kind of work that you do. And ultimately, you have to believe in the fact that people can change.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not, I mean, it seems easy, but it's not easy.
Yeah. And if we continue expanding the topic of taking responsibility and involving other people, so there are two types of approaches. There is a binary approach when the issue is handled from the perspectives of those two people who are involved. And there is this novel bystander approach where the people who are socially tied with the victim and the perpetrator are involved in solving the issue. So if, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with this approach. And do you use that in the programs that you take part in? And how is it important to develop it further?
So the perpetrator program that I worked with, we primarily worked with what you call the binary approach. We worked with the clients in the room, and then we reached out to their partners or former partners. But we often talked about engaging community, because if you look at the theory of change, and a person who decided to change goes through these five stages, and regardless of whether they're changing their alcohol addiction, drug addiction, bad habits, or abuse patterns and behavior in our case, they ultimately should reach the fifth stage, which is maintenance. So basically, you've gone through contemplation, pre-contemplation, action, actual change, and now you've arrived to maintenance, where for the rest of your life, you commit to being non-violent. So how easy is that? And again, if we go back to the first question, what drives men into our program? It's ultimately the fear of being penalized. So what keeps you at your new behavior? What helps you to maintain the change? It's either fear or being held accountable, or both, really, right? So yes, there's a component of fear, where you fear going back to jail, fear to lose your family. But there's also a component of where you surround yourself with men or women, preferably men, because men tend to rely on other men's opinions more, who remind you of your better self, who hold you to higher standards, and who believe that you have changed and you should be able to maintain that new, non-abusive, respectful pattern of your behavior for the rest of your life.
And if we expand this conversation even more, and if we bring it to, if we talk more about the social impact of this and the ways to handle it better, if we review the structures and rules of, for example, we'll say religious belief systems, the sports culture, the pornography culture, family structure, economics, race, so how important is it to handle this issue, not from the individual, so when you meet up with a person and you talk, but is there also a method to find out what's lacking in those global systems and what's causing those men to behave the way they do? And is there any sign of progress there? Because it's very hard to deduce what exactly in those grand belief systems is wrong and what's causing them to do things they do.
Yeah, so we all look for something to be hopeful about, and to, you know, towards signs of progress. So that brings us actually to our to my current job of running that project on masculinities in Belarus. Because ultimately, if you want to maintain a change in yourself, you should surround yourself with people who are already changed. And the more there are such people in the society, the easier it should be to surround yourself with such people, isn't it? So ultimately, you have to look at all levels. Whatever you mentioned is relevant. You have to look at schools. You have to look at gender stereotypes. You have to look at how do we become men? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a good man? And what does it mean to be a real man? And that gap in masculinities between idealistic real man and a good man is probably where we should dig deeper. So yes, you can intervene at any of these levels. You can do gender stereotypes, harmful gender stereotypes, education for young boys. You could do services, what my organization is trying to do. You could open online or phone services for men who want to discuss their feelings of being uncomfortable. Because ultimately, many psychologists would tell you that because we encourage boys to be tough, to grow up, to mm-hmm. be a tough man, they suppress a lot of their emotions, and the only emotion that they know how to express is anger. So how do we unpack that? What kind of interventions do we do for that? Sports, yes, is sports and ultimate manifestation of aggression. What about aggressive sports? The culture of dominance, where men are viewed as subjects, where they buy sex from women, buy sex from other men. You know, these are all the issues that you could do great. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of these fields could become interventions for questioning these stereotypes, questioning, expanding the norms of masculinity and redefining what does it mean to be men.
And if we go pretty far back into the stages of early development and early setting of gender roles and the understanding of what they are, you already talked about the understanding of masculinity that is given to the boys at the very young age. And I wanted to ask how important it is to bring that awareness to education, and is it possible to change? Because a lot of people view education as one of the only ways to reach out to those young people and tell them these are the red flags and these are the wrong things to do, and setting a good example and showing that you can love without being violent. So how important is education in setting the example for young boys and girls as well?
We haven't developed or we haven't invented anything more powerful than education. What we do with adult men is called educational program. It's not some kind of psychological hypnosis, mesmerizing tactics. This is ultimately education. And obviously, the younger you start, I mean, if it works for 30, 40, 50, 60, 80-year-old men who come to our program, the younger you start, the more, supposedly, the more flexible your brain is, so you can rewire in a healthier way. Because why do you need intervention for your behavior? That means your behavior is harmful to the rest of the society, and you're malfunctioning, you're not functioning. So many educators now argue that while we have expanded the definition of what does it mean to be a girl in a modern society, because in the West and in the US, the ultimate mantra for girls is you can be
anything. Yeah.
Anything.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For boys, can you paint your nails if you're a boy? Can you wear a skirt if you're a boy? Can you go into caretaking? Would you work in the childcare if you're a boy or as a nurse? Yes, but then they begin to question the level of your masculinity. Are you a real man? Are you gay? Because gay, then you have an excuse to do all those things. But if you are a straight heterosexual man, then you shouldn't paint your nails, you shouldn't wear a skirt, and you should go into a more manly profession. So that's why I've already talked a couple of times about gender stereotypes and gender roles. That's why they're so harmful for both for men and women.
And are there any educational programs I know there are some in the United States, but are there any educational programs for children and teenagers in Belarus that you know of?
So this is very tricky, because I think in Belarus, gender has a very bad reputation. As soon as you talk gender, I mean, even though within the legal field, you always have to talk gender as in binary, man, woman. But people still question your motivation, and they always think you're going to bring, and that's always a quote you hear sooner or later, that you're going to bring all 58 genders from Facebook into the realm of discussion. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. 58 genders from Facebook. I've never seen it, but I heard it already. At so many levels, no matter where the discussion is, in the streets, in the focus groups, at UN in Belarus, you ultimately hear that argument that you're bringing these 58 genders. So, I mean, yes, it's funny, but it's not, because you immediately become marginalized, because Belarusian society is pretty homophobic. They would close your access right away to young teenage audience, because you're not allowed to discuss such issues. And I don't know if you're following the Belarusian news, but in just this year, they have collected 58,000 of signatures under the petition to introduce similar kind of law that already exists in Russia on banning the homosexual propaganda and something else. So there's a very strong anti-gender, anti-feminist movement in Belarus that doesn't necessarily welcome these discussions with young people. But obviously part we still do that, and part of our project is educating young volunteers who would be able to do peer-to-peer education with their fellow upper level teenagers, because we don't want to we do want to work with minors, but we can't work with minors, so 17, 18 up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is too late to begin talking about gender stereotypes and gender roles, but this is our reality. This is what we deal with.
Yes, and also I wanted to ask also about the process when it comes to dealing with men's aggression, because we talked a lot about the possible progress in their behavior. I want to ask, how is it being tracked after they finished the program? So 40 weeks have passed, and so what's going to happen then? How is something happening there?
Yeah, great question. That the best of minds in US and all over the world are really trying to answer. So there's a simple answer, and the simple answer is we don't really know, but we're always very, very, very cautious in our reports and our assessments. So part of the, I wouldn't say it's a simple answer, I take my word back, it's more of a practical answer. So part of our work is holding men accountable. So each month we write a report for them, and that report is very detailed in terms that it contains their vital information, whether they attend the program, whether they show any progress in their thought process, whether they are able to talk about their previous harmful behavior without minimizing it, shifting the blame on women, negatively bonding with other aggressive men in the group. And these reports go, depending on how the client got into our program, these reports go out to the probation, to the Department of Children and Families, or to their partners. They always actually go to their partners if the partner requests. So through these reports, we're able, and through regular supervision, we're able to track their process of thinking and report on any, at least, I wouldn't say progress, but at least lack of open aggressiveness against their partner or former partner. We don't know whether they made real progress or whether they just learned how to get through our program without being penalized and sent to jail. We always think that they've just learned to do that for the sake of the program, I would say. We never assume that they have adopted this new behavior for life. But if you've learned to do that for 1 year for the sake of program, there's a chance that you might be able to expand it if you need it, if you want to save your relationship, if you want to stay away from jail, if you want to be a better partner in your current or future, or even to your former partner, if you still have kids, you've always be in contact with her, most likely, right? The big question, or the more kind of theoretical question, are these programs beneficial, and should they even receive any funding from the federal government, because they ultimately take some funding from the women's programs, right? This is the big question, that there's a lot of data, and ultimately they show that a well-run pro-feminist program, which, yes, educates men but also holds them accountable, reports to the women's organization and works with their partners, they are able to bring down the recidivism rate. That means that they are less likely to offend again. And that rate is, I think it's about 30% of the clients who complete the program are less likely to offend again.
So, yeah, and you also mentioned that people from the program, men primarily, they can return back to their relationship that they already had. I just want to ask, if I understand that it's kind of difficult to analyze and there is not much data for that, but is it possible to maintain a healthy relationship with an abuser even after the program? I mean, if people get back to the relationship, or it's just they are in the relationship just because of some different reasons rather than just healthy relationship.
Again, I think it's an ultimate question of, can men change? Can people change? Do we change? Can we change at the age of 17, 18, 40, 60? So yes and no. I mean, yes, it is possible to maintain a better relationship with a man who abused you, I suppose. But that depends on your definition of better, healthy, exactly what motivates you to stay. Can an abusive partner be a better partner? Yes, if he stops abusing. And if we unpack abuse, there's the physical part where he kicked you, threw you against the wall, held you down, and he can actually maybe stop doing that. But does other kind of abuse persist? Psychological abuse, financial abuse, sexual abuse? If that persists, is that already an improvement or not? Because for many women, physical abuse is really, really bad. But then the psychological abuse is just as bad, because he can probably stop punching you, but he'll still criticize you, manipulate you, put you down in front of your kids, will talk over you, will not incorporate your opinion into decision making. So is it better or is it worse that he doesn't physically abuse you anymore, right? I mean, there's. I think it's a very difficult question. I don't have a good answer, but I have a good example, though, that I've been working at Eberge for 4+ years, and on the fourth year of my work there, I was doing the intake for a man who came back to our program 24 years after the initial intake. The best part is on the same day. So January 24th, 24 years later, he came back to our program. He was with exactly the same partner that he initially enrolled in our program. And he never completed neither the first nor the second time. And he was abusive to his partner.
Did he come voluntarily to the program?
No.
No?
He was sent by court on both cases. He did jail term on both. I'm not sure about the first time, but he definitely did. He never completed because he went to jail on the second. So yeah, I mean, women stay in the same relationship with the same man, and we always reach out to, and for any pro-feminist organization working with men, it's ultimately very, very important to reach out for women, to women, and talk about their partners being in our program, because we don't want them to feel safer just because their men, their partners have come to our program. But also because, like I said, many women would say, you know, I want the abuse to end, but I don't want the relationship to end. And you have to consider that. It's never, never the intention of our program to either keep the relationship or break it up. Whatever the woman and the man ultimately think is the best, we will always listen to the woman if she agrees to talk to us, and we will do our best, work with men in a way that she feels safe making this decision.
And what about children? If a couple has children, are there any programs for those children who have witnessed domestic violence, who have not necessarily experienced it themselves, but who have witnessed? Because as we can see from the statistics, a lot of children who witness domestic violence, they later are very likely to become either abused or the abusers, since this is what they see from the very early stages of their lives. So are there any programs for children for that matter?
Yes, it's as far as I know, it's usually individual work, but we don't run such programs, so I wouldn't be able to comment on them. We do have a session on in perpetrator education. We have a separate educational session on effects of abuse on children. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you abused your child. It means that you abused your partner, and that already has affected your child in a major way. So we are really trying to drive that home. And also what our organization did, they opened free of charge fathers groups for men who are abusive to their partners. Because in many cases, court makes decision whether to, on the custody rights for the abusive men, they have him go through both programs, the perpetrator program and the father's program and fatherhood program. And in many cases, the organization that run this fatherhood program, they don't know the dynamics of an abusive relationship. So they are very generous with certificates and with very congratulatory of these fathers, because ultimately, if there's one characteristic of such profile of an abusive man, is that they're very manipulative. And they will go to extreme lengths to present themselves as very respectable and very dignified men. So they make such good appearances in these programs that ultimately they are praised as being great fathers. But our organization believes that you can't be a good father if you are a lousy, abusive partner, because you ultimately undermine your partner in front of your children. And this is... this ultimately undermines your whole fatherhood facade. So they open this free of charge program for fathers. So yes, there is a research that men who have seen violence have become or can become perpetrators themselves. But we should always be cautious when we cite that, because many men can use it as an excuse for their behavior, which should never be, really. And this is what is often referred to, or this and other elements are often referred to as psychologizing oppression. So basically you find these very fancy, deep psychological explanations for why men better. Yes, they have witnessed violence. They're influenced by these very strict masculinity norms. They are victims of harsh discipline. Yes, this might all be true, but it should never be used as an excuse, because we know many people who, men, women, men, boys, who experienced violence as children, and yet they never became perpetrators or abusers. Just like alcohol addiction or drug addiction should never be used as excuses.
And to end with hopefully a positive note, hopefully, I just want to ask, what's the perspective that you, as someone who worked on two different continents and two very different cultures with that issue, is there any positive perspective that you see in front? Because if we look at it, there has been so much more attention brought to it in the recent decades than previously, but still, is it enough?
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to be able to talk about positive. I think the fact that we talk more about these issues is definitely very positive. The fact that we question these gender norms a lot more often is definitely very positive. But I'm pretty positive also that we're going to have a lot of work to do, both in US and in Belarus. Yeah, because there will always be some inequalities, certain amount of abuse in the society. But ultimately, what we all should thrive towards is a more equal, more fair society where both men and women and children can exercise their rights and feel safe.
So now you've listened to the interview with Galina, and I want to thank her once more for giving us all this opportunity to learn more about the issue of gender inequality and domestic violence. And once again, I'm sure this was very educational, and I hope that you had some new thoughts going on and evolving in your mind while you were listening. And if you would like to share some of them with us, feel free, and you're welcome to do that actually in the comment section below. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe.